Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is in Charlottesville, Virginia. Naturalist Cy Montgomery has written before about good pigs, great apes, pink dolphins, and man-eating tigers. Now she has turned her attention to birds. In a new book, she details her relationship with a series of different sorts of birds, the familiar and exotic, tame, and otherworldly. She explores their remarkable skills and ingenuity and the surprising bonds they share with humans. The book is called Birdology, and Cy Montgomery joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
I'm so pleased to be here.
We invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour. You can call our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Or you can find us on Twitter or Facebook. So this book is called Birdology, which sounds very scientific. Is it really a word?
Actually, it was a word coined by a minister at a church I normally don't go to. But when my friend Gretchen Vogel saw that there was going to be a sermon on birdology at this little church, we went. And boy, am I glad that I did. The minister made up this word. She, of course, knows that ornithology is the study, the scientific study of birds. But she says, you don't need a PhD to be a birdologist. And she said, we all can be and should be. And the reason it was the subject of a sermon was she told us something I knew to be true, and that is that birds can strengthen your soul.
Now, how can birds strengthen your soul?
Well, a lot of different ways. For one, birds show us the divinity of creation. And when we watch a bird fly or we let our hearts soar on its song, it's like the gorgeousness of this world wells up before us. Birds also, I think, remind us of how to be humble, because look at them. You know, they're living, I'm quoting Henry Beston here, by voices we cannot hear. They have senses that we don't. They see colors we can't imagine. They can perceive the magnetism of the earth. They can hear things we can't hear. They can sing two notes at the same time. And this kind of keeps us humble.
What colors can they see that we can't see?
Well, we don't have names for them. But we do know that their eyes are quite different from ours. And people who've studied these things tell us that probably everything looks sort of iridescent to a bird, that colors are so vibrant they probably shimmer. And they also have amazing visual acuity, particularly the birds of prey. So here they are going through the same world that we share, but they're perceiving it in some ways much richer ways than we are.
You write that birds are actually fundamentally strange, so different from us. In what ways?
Well, one way is that, and this is the title of one of the chapters, birds are made of air. I mean, we humans are made of heavy fluids, and this binds us to the earth. And I'm sure you've heard of the ancients who believed that all of human health could be determined by the different combination of fluids and how they were doing. But birds are literally made of different stuff than we are. Their bones are hollow. Their skulls are scaffolded. Their feathers weigh more than their skeleton. But their feathers, too, are made of air. So they're that different from us. And when you think, too, of our ancestry, when we say animals, we usually are thinking of fellow mammals. And we humans, our ancestry, it diverged from fellow mammals maybe 100 million years ago. We diverged from the lineage that became the birds 325 to 375 million years ago. So actually, birds are dinosaurs. And yet, the thing that's so astonishing to me is that here's these winged aliens so different from us that they're actually made of different stuff. They come from a dinosaurian heritage. And yet, there are birds who can speak to you meaningfully in English. You questions, answer.
Now, that would
you know,
be a
answer
parrot.
Yours. Yes.
A parrot can speak to you and understand, have a conversation?
Yes. Actually, there's a woman who has studied this, Irene Pepperberg, who is now at Brandeis and Harvard. And she had at one time, she was working with three different birds, the most famous of whom was Alex, who died a few years ago unexpectedly at the age of 31. And Alex used more than 100 words very effectively to convey concepts, to answer questions, to ask questions, to make apologies, to lie sometimes. He used language in a way that showed that he meant it. And a lot of us who have parrots have seen that anyway.
So it's not just that parrots are just parroting what you've taught them to say.
No,
they
although
are
they
comprehending
can do that.
It.
And there's a lot of birds that incorporate the sounds of our voices, the sounds of machinery even. There are wild birds, I mean, not even parrots. There's things like lyrebirds and mockingbirds that will, they'll do a cell phone, you know. They'll do a dump truck. They'll do a chainsaw. And parrots can do that too. But if they choose, and they can come to understand what we mean, and they'll do it to play practical jokes on you. I've heard of numbers of people, and I've known some people in their parrots who speak meaningfully together. And some will do things like a lot of parrots learn to call the family dog. Fido, come here, Fido. And it's so perfect that the dog thinks it's the owner. They're doing it in the voice of the owner. And the dog comes running in and looks around. And then the parrot lets loose this peal of laughter. And I was sitting on a plane next to someone on my way to meet a very famous parrot named Snowball. And we got to talking. And he told me that he knew a parrot named Mickey who used to let himself out of the cage. And one day, while his parent was gone, he was out of the cage and their dog got him in his mouth. Well, the human came home and saw this was happening and yelled, "Put Mickey down!" Well, the dog didn't do it until the parrot himself said, "Put Mickey down!" And then the dog, astonished, just dropped the bird and he was fine.
Now, Snowball, you write a chapter about him. You danced with Snowball, is that right?
I did. On my 51st birthday, I danced with a sulfur-crested cockatoo.
And what does that mean, to dance with Snowball?
Well, one, it's a lot of fun. There's a video of him. Have you seen it? It went viral, like within seconds of it going on YouTube. He loves the Backstreet Boys and a number of other, and he rocks out to this song. It turns out a lot of parrots do this, but there's a neurologist who is studying this because what it shows, he actually keeps beat. You know, he keeps the beat when he dances, and this is called beat perception and synchronization, and it's indicative of very high cognitive functioning. Music and language, dance, they're all kind of related to a certain kind of brain you need to do all of these things.
So if someone wanted to see the video of Snowball dancing, they could just search for Snowball and Parrot maybe on YouTube.
Yeah, Snowball, and would, dancing cockatoo, and yeah, you'll go right there. And now he's on doing several different – he's been doing commercials. He's fabulous. And he's a real ham, too. He loves the camera.
Now, you say you wanted to write a book about birds for a long time. You've written a series of other books, books for adults, books for children. What brought you to write this book about birds now?
Well, as you said, I've been wanting to do it for a long time, and I was all set to do it a few years ago. And then my wonderful pig, Christopher Hogwood, died, and I wrote instead The Good, Good Pig, which is a memoir of our life together. But my first experience doing field work with wild animals was actually with emus, the tall, flightless birds that stand next to the kangaroo on the crest of Australia. And ever since then, I've been thinking very much about birds and wanting to write about them. And it came to me that the thing that I could write, there's many other birders better than I am, but the thing that I could write would be kind of exploring the essence of who birds are. And what are, I mean, this is a book that basically looks at kind of seven truths of understanding birds in a way that makes you see them in a new way.
And your first truth about understanding birds is birds are individuals. And you use as your example the chickens you have at home.
Yes, my ladies.
How are they individuals? I mean, I think a lot of people think of a flock of chickens as being, you know, just a flock of chickens.
Well, they need to come to visit us in Hancock because they would definitely see otherwise. People think chickens aren't very smart. Well, they are so wrong, because if you pay attention and if you're not looking at chickens who are in horrible battery farms, you will see they're highly individualistic. They have excellent memories. They have people and other chickens who they like. For example, our chickens never went across the street to visit the people across the street, even though they're perfectly nice people.
Well, but, why, they didn't like them?
Well, they like the people next door much more. Bobby and Jarvis Coffin move next door, and they love them. My chickens have been known to go up two flights of stairs to their back door of their porch and wait for them to come out. Whenever Bobby and Jarvis come out to get in the car, they are mobbed by the chickens who love them.
What, now, why do the chickens like them?
Well, I think it's probably the same reason that I like them, except in their case it might involve corn more than me. But it's not just the corn, because they come out when Jarvis lies in the hammock in the backyard. That's his day roost. They try to jump up and join him. And when Bobby comes out, sometimes she has to sneak out of the house to use her car and hope that they won't see her because she can't spend time petting them and talking to them.
So part of it is that they give them corn.
Well,
so
part of it is that.
Reward. But you're saying it's more than just
oh,
the
it totally
fact
is.
That they give corn.
They just really like them. And chickens, people don't realize this, but the average chicken can recognize 100 other chicken faces.
Now, how do we know that?
People have actually experimented with this. They can change chickens around. They can show chickens other chickens on TV. And chickens, you know, the pecking order, it's really more about order than pecking. But it's important to know who's who in a flock, because each chicken has a couple of friends that they like to be around more than others. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the others.
We're talking to Cy Montgomery about her new book. It's called Birdology. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850. When we come back after a short break, we'll go to some of your calls. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio is Cy Montgomery, author of The Good, Good Pig. Her new book is called Birdology. We're going to take some calls. You can reach us at 1-800-433-8850. Let's go first to Hank. He's calling us from Mitchellville, Maryland. Hank, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
The comment I wanted to make was, in fact, it was stimulated by... I was on the river cruise with Diane Rehm about a year and a half ago, and we talked about her book, the story of Edgar Sawtelle, which was about dogs and the communication between humans and dogs. And what I shared with the group at that time was when I was a kid growing up, I'm almost 70 years old now, so when I was a kid growing up, my dad raised homing pigeons out in Ohio. And when my wife and I were dating, one day we walked into her house, and as we were walking in, a pigeon flew into the garage area and up into the rafters. And I could tell by looking at it and by my experience that this was a thoroughbred racing pigeon. And I was able to get up on a ladder, and I had prepared by having a box ready, and the pigeon let me... while I was standing on this ladder, slowly move closer to the point where I was able to grab hold of them. And I knew how to handle them from having the experience with my dad. And I put them in the box, took them to my dad. And from the identifying band, we were able to identify the owner, who was probably 60 to 100 miles away. But there was a level of communication that I experienced with the pigeon that was based on my, you know, experience in growing up. And it was just a very unique experience to have, to be able to catch a, you know, pigeon that way.
All right, Hank, thanks so much for your call. Now, you write about pigeons.
Yeah, I've got a whole chapter just for Hank.
And their their amazing ability to navigate.
Yes, which is something I don't have at all. But, yeah, I got to work with folks who raise racing pigeons just like Hank's dad did. And it's a whole world of expertise. These folks know a lot.
How do pigeons know how to get home? How do homing pigeons know how to do that?
There has been so much study of this, and no one really knows. It's a whole bunch of different cues that they use. And interestingly, when different laboratories around the world do different experiments, they'll find, for instance, that one group of pigeons that they're studying will rely on smell, which is extremely unusual. Most birds, except for New World vultures, can't smell anything. And then they'll do this at another laboratory, and they use different cues. Some of them use visual landmarks. Some of them will actually fly along particular roads, just like us, instead of flying, quote-unquote, like the crow flies. Charlie Walcott has done a lot of work on this. He actually will fly a plane following the pigeons that he's radio-collared to see where they go. And he says they're relying on a whole bunch of different things, which is really smart, because one system is bound to get messed up, you know? One day your GPS isn't going to work, and one day Google Maps is going to be wrong. And so they use all kinds of different things, including some, they're believing that they can hear the, they can see, literally see with their eyes, the magnetism of the Earth. They can hear the infrasonic rumbling of the earth and the waves and the wind around mountains. They also have excellent, excellent memories. And they're relying on all these different things, a sun compass. But some days, you know, the sun isn't out. It's cloudy. And then what do? They believe that each loft has its own culture, and that in some lofts, they'll rely culturally more on, say, smell. And another loft, they'll rely more on landmarks.
Now, you've written also about crows in your book. And here's an email from a listener who says, I was looking out my window and saw some crows feeding on the ground. One of them went off by itself, flipped over a chunk of ground using its beak, dropped something in there from its beak, and replaced the chunk of ground back to where it had been. And as he headed back to join the group, another crow was heading toward whatever he had buried there. The first crow chased him away. I am amazed by the amount of thought that must have gone into this bird's activity. Is it common for crows to store things like this?
Oh, yes. That's a wonderful story. I'm so glad this listener shared it. Crows have a terrific memory. Crows belong to a family known as the corvids, and jays are among them. And there are some corvids who not only hide stuff and will remember it for a long, long time. They'll remember the location of hundreds of different things that they store. But there's some corvids who will hide it while other birds are watching them, and then they'll go back and move it because they know someone's watching them.
Now, crows do not have the best reputation. A lot of people don't like crows. Do they deserve that kind of negative reputation?
Well, no, of course not. I think, you know, a lot of people are upset by seeing lots and lots of big, black, noisy birds. And in the book, I write about a small city that was overrun when a huge crow roost of 50,000 crows moved into the downtown. And many people were upset. They felt it was like some kind of Hitchcock thing. But I think it actually goes beyond just a lot of big, black, noisy things. People don't like black hats. They don't like black sheep. But with crows, I think the thing that makes us uncomfortable, and this isn't just my observation, is that they're so like us, it creeps us out. They're really, really smart. They're really family-oriented. And they're not above using us and our technology to their own ends.
Like what would they do?
Well, this is a fabulous example. In Japan, recently it's become popular to grow walnuts as a crop. And crows love walnuts, but they're in these hard shells. So what the crows do is they go to the countryside where they pick up the walnuts in their shells, and they put them, they wait till the traffic light is red, and then they put them in front of the tires of cars. Then they fly away, wait for the light to go green, and the cars will run over the walnuts and open them for them. And this is just great.
That's hilarious. Let's go to Atlanta, Georgia, and talk to Pascal. Pascal, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I must just say I'm finding this conversation fascinating. But my question is this. You know, I'm an animal lover, and I do like birds. But I was wondering what your thoughts and observations were on, you know, birds being caged, parrots, macaws, that type of thing.
Well, you know, it is very hard to keep somebody as smart as a parrot in a cage. There's a lot of captive-bred animals who weren't taken out of the wild. But I'm really glad you brought that up, because there's many folks who believe that it's just impossible to keep a parrot in a cage when they really, parrots are social animals. They're used to spending their days with hundreds of other birds like themselves and many, many other animals. A typical parrot flies 50 miles a day, and they have relationships with lots of other individuals. A lot of the problems that you get with caged parrots involve the parrot falling deeply in love with you, and because they bond with a mate forever, and they live a long time, so that's a long time, sometimes it's hard to live up to what you need to be a parrot's lover. And what if you have a parrot who just doesn't like you? That's really terrible. Or what if you have a parrot who is in love with you, but you commit the terrible sin of, for instance, going off to college? There, this is what happened with Snowball's owner. He had fallen in love with the little girl in the family who grew up and went to college. And when she came back, he was livid. A parrot would never leave his mate, certainly not for weeks. So he flew at her and bit her and chased her around. I mean, he had every right to be angry, but he couldn't live in the house anymore if she's going to, you know, he's going to attack his mate. So that's why he got given up to a bird lovers only, a parrot rescue service.
Pascal, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
You know, on another line, we have a caller who says she shares her home with five parrots. Debbie is calling us from Queensboro, North Carolina. Debbie, you're on the air. Debbie, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. So tell us about your parrots.
Yes, I have done rescue. I have one green-winged macaw, a blue and gold macaw, two eclectus parrots, and a jardine.
Wow, great.
And
can we hear them? Will they say anything?
Yeah. Let's see if they'll say anything. Well, that was one of the macaws that just said something.
That's great.
Hey, Diego. They usually are closet talkers. They talk more when you're not in the room.
Right. Actually, Alex talked a great deal when the experimenters were out of the room, and they know that from a hidden mic.
Exactly. I have actually videos on YouTube of my birds in a shower stall singing "I'm a Little Teapot."
Oh, how cute. I'll have to see that.
But they, one of the things that, you know, there's one of them.
Yes.
One of the, when the last caller just brought up about keeping them in cages, the problem is there's no safe way to keep them in your house without a cage unless you have a completely enclosed aviary.
Yeah, which few people have.
Right, exactly, especially in suburban homes, which being in rescue, I often get in birds that are very misunderstood or have been abused, which some of the abuse that birds go through isn't just incredibly difficult to even imagine, such as one of the birds that recently came into a rescue had been locked in a dark closet for 8 years.
Oh, my gosh.
In the dark.
Awful.
And fed nothing but wild bird seed.
Oh, no.
Light that it would see, you know. So this is a 16-year-old bird that 8 years of its life was spent in the dark.
Oh, wow.
You know, so they come out of it incredibly traumatized.
And, how is this bird now?
Very fearful, but, you know, surprisingly resilient and forgiving.
Yeah, that's astonishing.
It is. I mean, it's, you know, it's not personally in my rescue, but it's a friend of mine that I know. So, I mean, you know, we have any number. But one of the things I do notice is that birds seem to be almost telepathic. They are so in tune with the emotions and the tensions in the homes that they live in. So if you have a, if you're having a bad day, your birds really do know. And I think that goes along with when they fly in flocks, how they know to turn.
Debbie, how do you know if you're having a bad day, how do you know that your birds know that you're having a bad day?
Just their reactions when they become more agitated. Their body language becomes more tense, or they scream more, etc.
Interesting. Well, Debbie, thank you so much for your call. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go back to the phones. We'll talk to Ryan. He's calling us from Durham, New Hampshire. Ryan, thanks for holding on.
Hello?
Yes, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm a longtime listener to the show and enjoying the program. I just had a comment. Earlier in the program, the speaker had mentioned birds being made of different stuff. And I'm a zoologist, and I always teach my students about the remarkable similarity between life forms. And I just think, you know, birds, yes, they have, you know, this wonderful organization and structure in their bones and their feathers. But, you know, their feathers are made of keratin, just like our fingernails. Their bones are made out of calcium. So rather than say they're made of different stuff, I think it would be more appropriate to say they're organized in a very fascinating way. You know, all life forms share the same DNA structure or similar DNA structure, and it's just, you know, something rather than say they're made of different stuff, say that they are organized differently.
Well, that's a good way of looking at it, too. I mean, I'm always astounding people by mentioning that we share 40% of our DNA with a daisy. So all of life, you're absolutely right. We are kind of all one family, and that is one good way to look at it.
The other thing I was going to say, too, is, you know, something that's silly in ornithology is, you know, you look at the cladograms of reptiles, and birds, reptiles, which can considered a non-monophyletic clade. And so what this means is that birds are placed separately away from reptiles. They're not in the class Reptilia, but rather avians. And, you know, they should be considered reptiles. As you said before, they evolved from dinosaurs. And this is somewhat of a silly joke that's sort of passed around ornithologists that, you know, they're studying something different than reptiles, but in reality... That's all they're doing.
Right. I have actually heard some scientists very much want to put them in Dinosauria.
Ryan, thank you so much for your call. Now, one of your seven essential truths about birds is that birds are dinosaurs, and you went in search of a bird that is particularly dinosaur-like. What kind of bird is that?
Oh, this was the cassowary, and this bird looks more like a dinosaur than many dinosaurs did.
What does it look like?
Well, it's 150 pounds. It stands as tall as a man. It has a great big tall helmet of bone on the head. It's not actually bone, but it looks like bone. And it has the most gorgeous, strong, scaly legs with a stiletto toenail on each foot with which it occasionally eviscerates people.
It sounds kind of terrifying.
Well, a lot of people did want to know, like, why do you want to go into the dark rainforest and find a big, dangerous bird that might eviscerate you? But they, if they know me well,
and
it's
so
a chance to
read
it.
Where did you go to see a cassowary?
The cassowary, there's three species, and they only live in New Guinea, the island of New Guinea, and in the wet tropics of Queensland, Australia. And I actually have been to New Guinea, where I did not meet a cassowary, but I went to Australia specifically to find a cassowary.
Now, you found this difficult. You had a hard time finding one.
Yes. People ask, were you afraid that you were going to see a cassowary? And no, I was afraid I wasn't going to see a cassowary. And I managed to see one on the last day. It was like the last hour of the last day. It was the most amazing thing. I had heard it the day before. And they have the most amazing sound. And this way, they're even more like dinosaurs. They're capable of making this astonishing infrasonic call that when you hear it, it feels like an earthquake. And if we were to hear it now, you would see the water in your cup move. You feel it in your chest.
Now, cassowaries, you say, weigh about 150 pounds. Can they fly?
No, which is fortunate.
So what makes them birds?
Well, feathers are one of the defining characteristics of birds, and they do have wings. And in places where cassowaries are found, the native people all have stories about when the cassowary once could fly. So interestingly, the people's ancient stories do mirror what we know from fossil evidence actually and from DNA evidence actually did happen. The ancestors of the cassowary could, in fact, fly. And many dinosaurs could fly.
And at the opposite end, you have hummingbirds, I guess, that would be very tiny and able to hover. Why can hummingbirds hover for so long?
They use their wings in a figure eight pattern, and they are the lightest birds in the sky. They are the most amazing. They are little more than air wrapped in iridescent feathers.
We're going to take another short break, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Cy Montgomery about her new book. It's called Birdology. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. By the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The brain in middle age gets easily distracted and forgets, but new research finds it's better at seeing the big picture and comprehending complexity. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Barbara Strauch, author of The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain. She's health and medical science editor at the New York Times. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking with Cy Montgomery about her new book. I'm going to give you the full and extended subtitle. It's called Birdology, Adventures with a Pack of Hens, a Peck of Pigeons, Cantankerous Crows, Fierce Falcons, Hip-Hop Parrots, Baby Hummingbirds, and One Murderously Big Living Dinosaur. Now, one of those you talk about in your subtitle is Fierce Falcons. What was your experience with falcons?
Well, I, for this book, got to take falconry for years. And I still go back and visit with these birds. It was a revelatory experience for me. I, of course, wanted to get inside of the brain of a bird of prey. And the way to do that, I think, better than anything else, is to enter into that partnership with the bird that is called falconry, hunting with the bird. And I'm a vegetarian. I'm the last person that you would think would be going hunting. But that was the only way to do this. And to hunt with these birds is the only way that they'll let you into their lives. And they will leave you if you're not a good hunting partner. So for years, I worked with Nancy Cowan of the New Hampshire School of Falconry. And the first thing we started doing was feeding the bird on the glove. And what do you think you feed them? Baby chicks, who, of course, I have raised for years. I've had chickens for years, dear little baby chicks who would spend the whole day in my sweater or on my head. And there you are with a dead one popping its heart out to feed to a hawk. But, you know, it was really wonderful. I learned how thrilling it is for the birds to hunt. In that way, I kind of got inside their head in a way I never could have before, in which you're so thrilled for the bird at being able to chase that everything else flies out of your head. The hunt, the chase, it's the only thing. And it fills the bird up. When the bird isn't hunting, it's almost like you're extinguishing a candle. And to be in that the hot light of that bird's joy as it does complete the hunt is worth almost anything.
You know, we've got several emails from people who writing about birds that fly into windows. Here's one of them from Krista, who's writing us from Chatham County, North Carolina. I have a juvenile northern cardinal that has come to the same window at this time every year for 5 years. For a week or so, he bangs against the glass as he attacks his reflection. We call him Crazy Bird. This bird does not have the crest of a grown male. Is it the same bird every year or the son of the bird from the previous year?
Oh, boy. Well, that I probably can't tell you. But first, I would say, please be thankful it's not a cassowary, because cassowaries do this too, and then it's a 150-pound bird who breaks the glass. He's seeing his reflection, of course, and or she, and thinks that, because females do it as well as the males, and thinks that this is somebody competing for the nest site or the mate. It might be a female. And what I would do, I've had this happen too with cardinals, I would either put up a silhouette of a hawk, or what I did was I had Owls of the Northern Hemisphere, which had a great big cover with an owl on it, and they start going towards what they think is a reflection, and they think it's an owl, and then they'll go away. They don't want to see an owl.
Let's go to Natalie calling us from Waxahachie, Texas. Natalie, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is great. I'm a bird lover from years and years ago and love watching them and interacting with them. And I got one shy, though, and I would wonder if your guest could give me any kind thing to think about grackles.
I know. They're very loud, and there's a lot of them. But they're actually good mimics. They're very smart. And remember, you know, we're very noisy, too. We can be very messy, too. I really feel like any bird is such a miracle to look at. When you look at it as, you know, here's this dinosaur flying around. When you look at it as, here's this being who's made of air. And when you look at a lot of them, think of the huge flocks of birds that once existed, the passenger pigeons. They no longer exist at all. They were one of the most numerous things on the planet, and we wiped them out. So when we see a big flock of something and we think, oh, gee, there's too many of them, maybe we should think back to the glorious flocks of birds that once were and be grateful that we could see a little fragment of that.
So, Natalie, does that make you think better of grackles?
Nope.
Sorry about that, Natalie.
Noisy, ugly, and messy, and they just drive me crazy because they're around all the time.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you. Thanks for your call. Now, you'd mentioned how passenger pigeons have declined.
Are gone. Yeah.
How about birds generally in the world? How are they faring?
They are declining at an alarming rate. In North America, since 1970, one quarter of our birds are in decline, including some of our most beloved birds like the bobolink. And things are even worse in Europe. Half of their common birds, including the skylark, are declining. And parrots are very, very threatened. Many species of hummingbirds are threatened with extinction. And we know why.
Why is that?
Well, for the usual culprits. It's human overpopulation, it's deforestation, it's pollution, it is global climate change. And I'm not saying this from a political perspective, but from BirdLife International, which is just a group of ornithologists and conservationists. So we know what the problem is, and we know how to fix it. So part of my hope in writing about birds and writing this particular book is that we realize what we could lose and that the birds can inspire us to get the courage and the wit together to do something about it and turn it around. Because this is our planet that we share with them. And if our birds are declining, well, look what's going to come around to us.
Let's talk to Thomas. He's calling us from Wake Forest, North Carolina. Thomas, hi, you're on the air.
I was wondering about Alex, the African gray, and whether he ever looked in a mirror.
Oh, he did. Oh, Thomas, I'm so glad you asked that. The first time Alex looked in a mirror, he had a question for the researcher. He said, what color? He'd never seen gray. He knew orange, he knew rose, he knew blue, he knew green. But actually, he wasn't with Irene at that time. He was, I think, with a student. And the student said, that's gray. You are a gray parrot, Alex. So he just wondered, you know, what's that? And was told, that's you.
But would he have flown into the window the same way the other bird had? Or did he know he was Alex?
Well, he was told he was Alex. And he probably did understand that he was Alex. And this is very interesting because they do this experiment, as you probably know, with lots of different animals to see if they have self-recognition, and they'll put like a spot of paint on your head and see if you reach up and touch that. The thing about windows and reflections and mirrors, of course, is that they're entirely new things to birds, and they don't come with the wiring to understand it. But Alex had an enhanced education. So he learned that was Alex. Now, most birds, if you put a mirror in their cage, they will behave as if it's another bird.
Well, thank you so much.
Thanks.
All right, Thomas, thanks for your call. Now, I wonder if some people would think, you know, we're really projecting here. We're, what's it called, anthropomorphizing, giving human characteristics to non-humans. Do you think there's some degree that happens when we talk about birds and we see in them human qualities, human bonds?
Oh, I think that's what happens with people's children all the time. We're always saying, little Johnny was just saying, you know, anti-disestablishmentarianism, and he just said baba. But this is why Irene Pepperberg has conducted these extremely careful experiments to see what Alex really understood and what he did not. And she would, for instance, give him a whole tray of objects, and there would be green cubes and wool balls, and they'd be different colors. And she would say, you know, what's the same with these two? And he'd say color, and, you know, what's different? And he'd say shape. And he would say what was a three-corner, four-corner thing. And then he would ask what he wanted as a reward. And actually, she was asking him stuff that she knew was kind of below his cognitive level, but had to test it again and again. So he would get bored. And one of the best stories that Irene tells, and she also tells it in her wonderful book, Alex and Me, is how one day she was giving him the same old test over and over and over, and he got bored and he kept saying, want a nut, want a nut. Well, she was never giving him a nut. Finally, he decided, since he had been studying phonics, that he would spell it out. So he said, want a nut, N-A-T-A. And he finally got his nut.
Let's go to Randy. He's calling us from Coral Springs, Florida. Randy, thanks for joining us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. I just wanted to share a unique experience I had. I used to do volunteer work at a zoo in the Hollywood, Florida area. And there was I'm not a great bird person, but it was a green and yellow parrot, medium-sized bird. And his name was Rio, and he sat at the front of the place at the door when you came in. And on the times when we had nothing to do, I'm a musician, I would sit and play guitar, and he would sing along with me. Well, after a time, I would do improvisational pieces with the bird, and he would actually not only follow along, but also sometimes lead in that improvisation of singing, which totally makes sense because birds sing.
That's right.
But it was quite an amazing experience, and I'll never, ever forget it.
Wow. That is pretty amazing, Randy. Thanks for calling. You know, here's an email we've gotten about bird singing. It comes from Kelly, who writes us from Dallas. Kelly writes, I'm a conservation ornithologist, and I want to tell you the story of the Bachman warbler. It's a bird of the American South not seen since the 1960s and now presumed to be extinct. From time to time, very accomplished birders and researchers swear to have heard the Bachman's distinctive song coming from the swamps in the Carolinas. It was finally discovered that the song was real but was coming from mockingbirds who learned the Bachman warbler song from their fathers, who learned it from their fathers, and so on across many generations back to the time when the warbler was still alive.
Wow. Wow. That is really, really moving, Kelly. Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. You know, mockingbirds are amazing. Roger Torrey Peterson told me that he and his neighborhood had a mockingbird who lived near the auto shop, and he would mimic all the sounds of the sick motors, you know. And parrots have been known in the past to be speaking dead languages of Indian tribes who were wiped out by disease. So they are kind of memory for us.
So they didn't learn it from people speaking that language. They learned it from birds speaking that language.
Yes, it was passed down. The initial birds learned it from people. And then when the people were gone, the birds carried that language forward.
Now, Becky has written us an email saying, any suggestions about attracting hummingbirds to my garden, and when should I put out the feeder? What about attracting hummingbirds? How can you do that?
Oh, well, certainly you can plant the kinds of plants that they like. They love red, and they love tubular flowers, and their wonderful beaks have kind of grown into that shape in order to specifically pollinate these tubular flowers. So plant a lot of red tubular flowers, and you can put out feeders as well. Be sure that you follow the directions for making the nectar. If you make the nectar, if you don't ever put anything other than what they direct, which is sugar and water, and use the right combination and clean it so it doesn't get icky. Also, don't use any pesticides, because something people don't understand is that while the average hummingbird will visit 1,500 flowers a day, he'll also be eating 500 to 600 insects every day. And so they will be absolutely thrilled if both of these things can be found nearby, and they will nest in your yard if they don't have far to go between their insect resource and their nectar resource.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We've been taking your calls and reading some emails. Let's go to Robert, calling us from San Antonio, Texas. Robert, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for the program. My wife and I live on a hilltop just north of San Antonio, and we have some hummingbird feeders on our deck. And last fall, when hummingbirds were beginning their migration, one of them flew into our sunroom, which is largely glass, and we just left the door open, and it couldn't figure out how to get back out. And when I found it, it was kind of exhausted on the windowsill. So I quietly walked to it and put my finger in front of its breast, and it crawled up on my finger and stayed there, and I walked to the door, and then it just flew away. Now, the very next day, the same thing happened with a hummingbird with totally different, very vivid coloration, and the whole experience was repeated a second time, and it was kind of astonishing to see something so delicate and tiny sitting there on your finger. And there's one last experience that happened right next to the sunroom. We have a two-car garage, and another hummingbird flew into the garage, and the door is 16 feet wide, and it couldn't figure out how to get out the door. So this time I couldn't figure out a way to get near it. So I had a insect net, and I finally caught it. And the bird was kind of exhausted and disoriented. So I took it outside and reversed the net. It flew straight up, and it was late in the day when the bats were out, and it got up about 150 feet, and a bat just swooped down and snatched it right out of the air, thinking it was an insect.
Oh, no.
Yeah, but those were three hummingbird experiences that I'll never forget.
So that's amazing. Thanks so much for calling. Now, you've worked with hummingbird rescue, Cy.
Yes.
How does that work? They're so tiny, those creatures.
Oh, gosh. Working with them, actually, that's the chapter called Birds Are Made of Air, because baby hummingbirds. There is nothing more delicate. They hatch out of eggs the size of navy beans, and they're the size of bumblebees. And I worked with this wonderful woman, Brenda Sherburn, who raises and releases orphaned baby hummingbirds. These little tiny things, at first they don't even have any feathers. And we fell so in love with these birds. Our lives were ruled by these tiny birds. Every 20 minutes, we had to give them a mixture of 200 squashed fruit flies and nectar and this special formula, and had to feed them with a syringe. We had to look at them to see their feathers. We needed a magnifying glass. And every 20 minutes from dawn to dusk, that's what we did.
Cy Montgomery, thank you so much for joining us this hour on The Diane Reem Show to talk about birdology.
Thanks so much.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Reem. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Reem Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.